Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us today for our discussion on The Gathering Storm, Equity Compensation Under Attack. This is Christina Cosley. I am present in Menlo Park with Bruce Daniel, Brooke Stow, Sharon Hendricks, and Michael Stiver, along with our live guests for a roundtable discussion. We have guests live in Canton's New York and Chicago offices and over 100 online participants. We are going to begin with a brief overview of the topic and, as time allows, move on to a Q&A session. Those of you who have joined us by webcast will have an opportunity to submit questions throughout the program, which we will do our best to address during the Q&A or after the presentation concludes. With that, I will turn it over to Bruce to tell us exactly what the plaintiff's bar is up to.
Thank you, Christina. Good afternoon, everyone. Let's start off by talking about the genesis of these new cases that we're seeing. And I think an appropriate title for this program actually would be The New Highway Robbers or Highwaymen, because basically what this amounts to is if you want to walk down the road to getting shareholder approval, you're going to have to pay a toll to the plaintiff's lawyers on an increasingly larger number of matters where you seek a proxy vote. This really all started with what we call the merger objection cases. These are simply cases where a public company would get acquired, plaintiff's bar would come in and say that the deal's not fair to the shareholders and or there's not enough disclosures for shareholders to make an informed vote. Those cases have been around for a couple of decades, but until 2006, they were fairly rare and usually actually had some merit or there was something wrong with the deal. But starting in 2006, a few specific plaintiffs' firms in particular decided this would be a great business. And so by starting then until today, there have been studies showing that about 95% of merger cases where a public company is being acquired results in a lawsuit. Now, why is this? Basically, it's a perfect model for extortion. There is a presumption that when there's a merger taking place that you can't unscramble the eggs after the merger actually goes through. So if there's something unfair about the deal or their disclosures were inadequate, there will be irreparable harm. So you start with one foot in the hole in that situation. It then comes down to whether or not they can show a likelihood of liability on the merits, which comes down to, in most cases, if there's something materially missing or materially misleading. That is normally viewed by judges as a fact question, which means you're not going to get rid of the case by a motion to dismiss, and therefore most companies relent and say, all right, we'll make these additional disclosures and we'll pay you some attorney's fees. Another study recently showed that about 80%+ of these cases resulted in no improvement on the deal for the shareholders of the company, but merely some additional disclosures and, of course, a nice reward for the plaintiff's lawyers. Now, these cases, when they first started blossoming, were inexpensive to dispose of, and therefore, they were quickly settled. You could get rid of one of these cases for $100,000, maybe it would go up to $200,000, $250,000. That has dramatically changed over time. Not that the cases have become more serious, but the plaintiff's bar has become more greedy, and so today, the number tends to start at $500,000. It goes up to $1 million, and if it's actually a large deal and a fairly serious matter, it can go into the millions of dollars. So that's the background on what we're seeing today, which really started in 2012. Let me back up a minute. The Dodd-Frank Act was passed, of course, in 2010. It had the advisory say-on-pay provisions in it. Plaintiff's bar decided it would try to make a living off of that so that if there was a negative vote, they would come in, file a derivative suit claiming there was a breach of fiduciary duty by the directors in going ahead and approving compensation against the negative vote. They had a resounding failure in bringing those suits. Out of the 15 suits that were brought, 14 were dismissed at the pleading stage. So they have given up on those. We really don't see those any longer. But what they've now decided is, hey, let's take that merger model that works so well for us, let's apply it in this context, and instead of waiting until the vote has taken place, let's enjoin the vote. Let's enjoin it on the basis that there are material omissions from the proxy statement regarding compensation, and hold up the company, pose the threat that the vote won't be permitted to go through, and make them pay us some attorney's fees. They also then segued from that into saying, well, you know, this act, we could actually use this for other executive compensation-related votes, such as increasing the number of shares in the incentive plan or other such matters. And that's what we've now experienced, and there's been a flood of these, really, mostly in the last half of 2012, and frankly, there will be many more going forward. Now, who are the protagonists here? Who are the highwaymen on these particular cases? It's the Farooqui and Farooqui firm. A little info on them. There are about 40 lawyers. They're a growing firm. You're probably going to see more of them, particularly in the corporate governance area going forward. The fellow who heads up their corporate governance litigation is a fellow named Juan Monteverdi. His main attribute is that he's shameless. He will file any case if he thinks he can get a buck for it. He has no standards of merit for the cases. He just wants to file in volume. And they have managed in really mostly the last 6 months to file file 24 pre-vote injunction suits. And they've sued some significant companies. They sued Microsoft, Symantec, Clorox, Cisco, and others across the country. In addition, they put out these notices of investigation on the newswire, and there were 32 of those. And you might think, oh, the 32 didn't succeed, so they're not doing that well. But in fact, what's happening, I discovered this recently, is that to make it even easier for them, they will send a demand letter and a draft of a complaint to the company before they bring a lawsuit and say, you can get rid of this. We don't even need to do this on a class action basis. Just make some disclosures and give me some money. And there have been a number of those. And those are off the grid, so we don't know exactly how many, and we don't really know what the tab is, although I understand it's around 100 grand to do one of these bargain basement deals without getting sued. So that's the protagonist here. It's important to know who you're dealing with. In conversations with him, he said, this is a great business model for us. It's great cash flow. And so we love it, and we're going to keep doing it. And we're increasing our staff of lawyers, and we're going to do more of it going forward. So expect more. We haven't even hit the main proxy season yet. That's coming up. So on the CNP cases, basically the theory is that you haven't been provided enough information to make an informed advisory vote on shares. These cases have, whether it's just that claim, have been largely unsuccessful, at least at the preliminary injunction stage. The AAR case, which we handled, the court denied the injunction, has actually stayed discovery. We have a motion to dismiss on file. If she rules the way I think she will rule, it may really cause him problems with bringing these types of cases going forward. A very well-respected federal judge in Chicago. Symantec, another one, injunction denied. However, what I've been told is that in the cases where the injunction's been denied, the case has not been dismissed. He's going to go forward, and he's hoping to get some wins at actually a trial or a settlement later on in the case, figuring that if he gets some discovery and he finds all sorts of stuff that wasn't disclosed that a judge might view as would be of interest to shareholders, they'll get some wins under his belt and he can be back in business on the CNP cases. The other types of cases that he's brought, which I think he's having greater success with, are cases where basically the company is asking for a shareholder vote to increase the number of shares available under an equity incentive plan for executives. And they make allegations in these cases that should have disclosed the projected equity value of shares. They don't define what that means, but I think they're talking Black-Scholes. Black-Scholes requires all sorts of assumptions. You know, you could write 100 pages on just all the different assumptions. Dilutive impact, which anyone could actually figure out if they did a little math. And then the one that they really press on is, why are you asking for more shares if you've already got a substantial number of shares available in the plan? Why now? You know, what's your purpose for that? So on those, they actually started off with a great success in a lawsuit filed against Brocade here in the Valley, and they actually got a preliminary injunction preventing the vote. This was a case where the Brocade was trying to add, I think it was 35 million shares to its equity incentive plan, and he was later rewarded with a fee award of $625,000. Building on that success, a bunch of companies quickly capitulated, agreed to make disclosures, didn't fight the cases, and the fees here are $125, $250 to $350, $225, and there most likely have been others as well. At the same time, there have been a number of defense victories. The Amdocs case, which was the first one of these, by the way, and it was a year ago in January, we defended that. We actually moved to dismiss it right away, and they decided they were going to fight another day. So they voluntarily dismissed the complaint. Ultratech, the injunction was denied. Cases proceeding. Plantronics, denied proceeding. Applied Minerals, I think, maybe one of the first where they basically decided, we're going to dismiss the class action and we'll settle with you on an individual basis. I can't disclose the amount, but it was very inexpensive. So, and that now he's taken it a step further with these demand letters and the like. So, again, the cases where, those cases where he doesn't have, didn't get his injunction, he's nonetheless going to proceed. In Clorox, for example, the court denied the injunction, but ordered an expedited discovery and an expedited trial to take place before the shares are actually used in September. So we'll actually get a trial result or potentially a settlement in that one. Now, the most recent development is a new type of case that's being brought by the Levi and Krasinski firm. And by the way, Monteverdi used to be at Levi and Krasinski. He ran their corporate governance group there. So I guess they've been following it. They've taken a different approach, however. And this is still an early stage. It's basically taken place in the last couple of months. They've been actively noticing investigations, at least 15 that we've seen. But so far, only three cases have been brought that we're aware of. They're not in a rush. They're not seeking an injunction. They're bringing a derivative suit, claiming that the company violated some of its own internal rules on plans and the like. So they could file those, you know, well down the road and still be in a timely way. There are no decisions yet in these cases because they've been filed so recently. And so what we've done is we've looked at the investigations, which say almost nothing, and say, you know, we're investigating the proxy statement relating to executive compensation. But then we've looked at what the company was doing, and we've also looked at the lawsuits that have been filed, and they seem to fall into these three categories, where the company actually issued common stock in excess of the amount authorized by shareholders, where they were equity awards to executives in excess of the number allowed by the shareholder-approved equity incentive plan. And then interesting one is executives selling too many shares and not holding the minimum number required by corporate governance policy. And we may see other additions to this, but it seems to be the main thing that they're pursuing right now. So all of these cases can be prevented by disclosure practices. This is not like securities class actions where you can't avoid it if the company has an adverse problem and its share price drops. You know, that happens and you may get sued in that situation. Here we're talking about basically following to the letter, requirements of the corporation, adequate disclosures and the like, and I'm going to turn it over to Sharon to talk about some ideas. Actually, I guess we've got one more thing, right?
Right.
First talk about Section 162M cases.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Mike Diver with Catton. Just to follow on to Bruce's commentary, we have a broader group of bandits, I guess, bringing cases alleging either a failure to provide proper disclosure, adequate disclosure with respect to a company's compliance with 162M under the IRC, or an absolute failure to comply with the terms of 162M, resulting in some harm to the company or a breach of fiduciary duty. There have been a number of cases brought in this area. I just want to quickly touch on some basics on 162M because they bear on the theories that the plaintiffs have been bringing. So it is a cap on the deductibility of compensation afforded to executive officers. Significant exceptions to compensation that is based on qualified performance-based metrics. The compensation that's at issue is basically comp paid to CEOs and NEOs, other than CFOs. Sorry for the many acronyms there, but we're basically dealing with senior Section 16 officers of the company, or NEOs other than CFOs of companies. The basics of the plan, of the exemption, are the compensation must be granted by a comp committee consisting of at least two independent directors. And here's a key one, the material terms of the company's plan, including the specific performance goals, must be disclosed to and approved by shareholders. The goals themselves must be predetermined and objective. The comp committee must certify compliance with the goals before any payments are made to executive officers. And this may seem like a technical rule, but it's actually had real-world implications in at least one case. Plans must be reapproved every 5 years if, under the terms of the plan, a comp committee is given discretion to change performance goals that had previously been approved by shareholders. So flipping to the next slide here, the theories that have been pursued, generally seeking, by the way, recovery of compensation and injunctions against future payments to executives for allegedly violative payments, disclosure-based claims, either you know, the company failed to adequately disclose performance goals or disclosed, in fact, allegedly falsely, that it was that the company was in compliance with the terms of 162M when, in fact, it was not, things of that nature. Then you have, in the derivative context, the traditional breach of fiduciary duty claims, allegations that the board and the comp committee failed to require compliance with Section 162M when granting executive compensation, or unjust enrichment, waste claims, in fact, in one case at least, public policy claims that compensation was issued that was not performance-based under 162M, thereby harming the company by depriving it of, in some instances, significant tax savings. Deductibility savings.
And I'm going to jump in right now because we have a question from one of our online participants, and I think it's a good one. She asked, what are the damages they allege in these cases? And I can defer to Bruce to discuss that, but I think for the most part, they don't really have damages. The pre-vote cases, they would allege their damage is that they are being asked to cast a vote that's not fully informed. That damage can only be cured by an injunction. The post-vote cases, dilution for the most part to the extent it involves the issuance of shares, but that's one, really one of the unique features of these cases are it is not like there's a stock drop in a classic securities class action. These are cases in which the damages are something that the plaintiff's bar has really dreamt up, and primarily they're motivated by plaintiff's fees, and it's hard to see them motivated by anything else when you're talking about the adequacy of disclosures, especially when these aren't merger votes. You know, the merger votes, they can't be undone. That's unscrambling the egg. But with these cases, it's really nothing that if there were an omission that couldn't just be cured with an 8K. So to the extent people are asking what the damages are, they're speculative. They haven't been litigated yet. That's something we've been focusing on as we litigate the cases, and I think the plaintiffs themselves are struggling to articulate that. So I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mike, but
no,
I thought that was a fair point.
I mean, just one additional comment. It's not, these are not damages cases. What they're seeking, for example, in the CNP cases where they didn't get a preliminary injunction, is a revote with the shareholders being properly informed. And then, of course, an attorney's fee award to them for having brought about a revote, which, you know, benefits supposedly the shareholders. That's the whole idea of these cases. Mike?
Yeah. And so I know we've got a lot on the docket here, but I want to just cover a couple of the cases that have been successfully brought by plaintiffs in Delaware, the ADM and Qualcomm matters. In ADM, there was an allegation that effectively the company, the comp committee and the board failed to obtain shareholder reapproval of a plan that had been adopted earlier in 2007, and that there was insufficient disclosure of the specific performance goals that executives were subject to under the plan. So as Bruce said, this is a situation where you have sort of a technical rule that apparently someone may have missed, and you have a situation where with some additional disclosure in the proxy statement, the matter may have been avoided entirely. Qualcomm was a bit of a different animal. I think the most significant fact to take out of Qualcomm was that the board or the court actually made a determination that demand was excused under Delaware principles of derivative claims because the directors who had approved the plan and recommended the plan to shareholders were, in fact, eligible to participate in the LTIP plan that was the subject of the plaintiff's allegation. So it raises a kind of a thorny issue with respect to director participation in plans that become the focus of these cases. And the next slide here covers a similar situation where you have a case brought and actually surviving a motion to dismiss and a court determining that entire fairness should, under Delaware law, be applied rather than the business judgment rule in a situation involving grants to directors, the court effectively determining that because directors had allegedly received excess compensation, you know, they could not be deemed to not disinterested. I always trip over that. And therefore could not avail themselves to the business judgment rule. Frankly, once you lose the business judgment rule, there's settlement value in a case like that for derivative plaintiffs. And it really creates a situation where you effectively have to get into discovery to determine what the standard of care was and whether the board in fact met that. So how to avoid being sued? As we've mentioned a couple times now, solid proxy statement disclosure is probably the best preventative measure, and we'll touch on, I think, some best practices and ideas as to how to evaluate your CDNA for the upcoming proxy season. One thing is, and I think this is a fact that has been cited in at least a couple of the cases where plaintiffs were not able to prevail on a motion to dismiss, is disclosure that, in fact, the comp committee may grant equity compensation that is not compliant with 162M. It may seem like a very simple fact to state, but I know it may have implications from a shareholder relations standpoint if you have that type of disclosure in your proxy statement. But it is something that can afford a comp committee and a board of directors a significant amount of safety and benefit. Sort of in along the lines of defending a merger case, we recommend that if you have a situation coming up where your plan is being put up for shareholder approval, that you bring in litigation counsel to at least look at your disclosures prior to the filing of your proxy statement, and that you create a good, solid corporate governance record with respect to the manner in which the comp committee and the board and its advisors analyzed and assessed the terms of comp committee plans that are going to be put up to a shareholder vote. So things sort of blocking and tackling simple things like making sure you have a good, solid set of minutes, reflecting advice provided to the comp committee from its compensation consultants, from its outside legal counsel, et cetera, regarding the recommendation can be extremely helpful because those documents may very well be the subject of discovery. So with that said, I'll turn it over to Sharon.
Hi.
We're going tax deductibility. Can that in and of itself give rise to a wasting claim? Or?
Well, it's been alleged. It has been alleged. What the court in the XTO matter, which we cite in one of the earlier slides, a couple of things out of that case. They said, number one, the disclosure of the fact that, hey, we look for various good, solid business reasons. We may decide to grant compensation that doesn't comply with 162M, so shareholders are on notice of that. And in that matter, I thought it was the court went on to emphasize the fact that it was going to defer and apply the business judgment rule, provide the board and the comp committee with great deference in matters relating to executive compensation. So that is one area that they very clearly said the business judgment rule should be applied.
Which means you should be fine.
And I would say that in my experience, most proxy statements will have a sentence in there saying that the committee or the company may or may not have compensation, comply with 162M, so reserving the right to make the business judgment depending on what's going on at the time and whether that issue is the most material or the most important from the business perspective. So I'm Sharon Hendricks, and my colleague Brooke Stow and I are grateful for being included in the panel. We're from Gunderson Dettmer, and while our Catton colleagues here help once there's a problem, we're in the position of advising the companies of what to put in their SEC filings and how to manage their proxy statements, whether for annual meetings or for mergers up front. And so, you know, this has been an eye-opening experience to prepare for the panel and to hear about these developments because they are quite recent. I mean, it does sound like a lot of these have come only over the last 6 months and there's not hard learning yet out of it. They asked me to address some of these issues about how to avoid being sued. And Mike, at the bottom of the slide you were talking from, it says one of the recommendations is submit equity plans for approval a year in advance, which, you know, I think the purpose of that, and I would just editorialize that that's not all that common. I mean, most of the companies we work with would wait until a year where they need it, and so they wouldn't do it too far in advance, perhaps including because it might be harder to address the issue of why you need shares if you still have an ample reserve. But one of the recommendations coming out of this, I think because of the, maybe because of the injunction cases, is to do it early so that you can build in some extra time to work out all of these issues before you actually need the shares. From a disclosure perspective, I'm going to pick through some of the recommendations that are coming out of these developments with respect to the say-on-pay votes. And it sounds like it may not be that necessary to draft disclosure or include disclosure simply to avoid litigation on the say-on-pay votes, maybe not as much as on the share issuance votes. But nonetheless, the learning coming out of those cases is that companies might consider including the reasons they selected their compensation consultant, include a fair summary of the compensation consultant's analysis that was provided to the board or the comp committee, the reasons the company chose the particular mix of different components of comp, the reasons for choosing the peer group, details concerning financial or other compensation metrics concerning peer group companies, and consider going beyond what item 402 and 407 of Regulation SK require. And I mean, that point is consistent with the SEC's pronouncements somewhat vitriolically about 6 or so years ago that the disclosure regime is a principle-based disclosure regime. The rules can't identify everything that needs to be addressed because every company's circumstances differ. And so the need for some thought going into what elements of the company's behavior and future the compensation-related proposal might touch on in the future.
I might just briefly expand upon those comments. If you step back and look at the process of advising a comp committee, typically there will be a compensation committee report. There will be a management slide deck or slide decks summarizing that management committee report and the recommendations of management. There will be those recommendations are considered, and there will be, at the end of that process, compensation decisions. What are bonus is going to be, what are the metrics going to be, what are the equity rewards going to be. And as a lawyer advising a company, I think you need to consider that first, prepare the CD&A to make sure that there's nothing in those documents that's inconsistent with the CD&A, and that the CD&A, in fact, represents a fair summary of this kind of universe of documents. So I think if you're the lawyer advising the company, you need to do that. And you may also now need to be a bit more proactive in reviewing those management slides and that management report before they're formally issued, with an eye to the disclosures that you're going to need to include in the CD&A to avoid this litigation.
In connection with the share issuance suits, the types of additional disclosure that might be considered that are coming out of the still preliminary decisions and filings in the case would be projections considered by the board related to share usage under the equity plans in the future. I mean, that could touch on if the board is looking at and approving guidelines, I mean, employee guidelines by position for equity grants that, you know, if you're a director level one, it's between 60 and 70,000 shares for new hire. That sort of thing that comp committees routinely look at, but is a level of detail that goes far beyond what we see in proxies historically and what we would expect to see, and also has some competitive implications in terms of what the company's offering people to hire them. The reasons that the company determined the number of additional shares requested to be authorized. I mean, I think most companies, when they're submitting to the board and the comp committee, a proposed number to seek approval for would make projections about hiring needs and retention needs and what they intend to use. Currently, I think the discussion in the proxy statement about that has to do with burn rate and what the historical burn rate has been, and doesn't get into much more detail than that. The potential equity value and or cost of the authorization of additional shares, Bruce mentioned earlier that, you know, the equity value of the shares, and you know, the Regulation FK doesn't require that the company use a certain set of assumptions and articulate what the accounting cost or the financial statement expense of using every share under this particular type of award or that particular type of award, each with their own set of assumptions, would be. And I think to your point about share usage and dilution, you know, the numbers are there. People can make their own estimates. But it sounds like there may be some pressure to consider putting that type of information in. Describing a fair summary of the consultant analysis. I mean, there's a lot of information. There's a lot of market data in those. So, you know, currently what's included has to do with benchmarking against particular percentiles. And so I'm curious as to whether a deeper dive on those analyses will be required. And I think what really came through to me in listening to the information that the litigators are providing us has to do with the need. I mean, we're dealing with various regulatory regimes applying to compensation. And so you do certain things for tax purposes for 162M that allow you to comply with the tax rules and put the company in a position to have full deductibility of the comp. But beyond those rules and requirements are other considerations that, so by saying, you know, the plan requires that we don't grant more than 500,000 shares to an individual in a given year, you know, the fact that you might be able to grant awards outside of a shareholder-approved plan under the exchange rules you might need to think about whether you should mention that you're reserving the right to do that. It's not directly related to what's in the stock plan, but it's sort of in the broader context that the stock plan plays into.
Before you move to the last one, let me just explain something. What she's just described to you as the things you might want to consider including, no court has said you had to do that. No court has actually ruled on what is required and what would be a material omission. This is simply a list of what the plaintiffs are saying a company should have disclosed, a collection from the various cases that have been filed, and therefore it's there for your consideration whether you want to include these or not. The only court that has actually said the disclosures were inadequate is the Brocade Court, and it was basically went to explain to me why you need another 35 million shares for your equity incentive plan when you've already got currently another, you've got 8 million available to you. Why do you need so many shares? So if you just use common sense in these situations, hopefully judges will use common sense, and you won't get burned by it.
Yeah.
I think it might be worth noting, especially for the Silicon Valley company, that the Brocade decision did come out of the Santa Clara County Superior Court. So that binding law, perhaps across the country, but for those of us that are here in the Valley, it is perhaps worth considering. And if anyone wants to see a copy of that decision, please go ahead and contact any of us after this, and we're happy to circulate it, and you can make your own views in connection with the disclosures that it seemed to suggest the company should be making. Sorry, I'll turn it back to Sherry now.
A few other, I guess this goes more towards actions taken after a vote is obtained, of things that companies need to pay attention to, making sure that they're not granting shares in excess of the plan limits. And there are a variety of plan limits. I mean, there's the aggregate maximum number that can be granted under the plan. Many plans have sort of what I call sub-limits that limit the number of full value awards to a subset of the total number of shares in the plan. Some of those limits take on the form of a ratio driven by ISS recommendations in terms of if you can grant, you know, three option shares for every one share of restricted stock or something like that. So there's a ratio that derives from industry by industry, and then annual caps that are driven by 162M. And so there are multiple ways that the caps in the plan might be exceeded. It sounds like that's been an active area of plaintiff's activity, and it wasn't clear to me in reviewing what I've seen so far exactly what limits were exceeded or how it all fit together, but that sounds like it's ripe for perhaps just simple mistakes. I mentioned before the fact that you can do non-shareholder approved grants outside of a plan, but that might have implications depending on what you said about your share usage for compensation in getting plans approved. This was interesting to me. If executives and directors are required to hold a certain number of shares under ownership guidelines, if they fall below that, if they sell in excess of what they're required to hold, do you have faulty disclosure with respect to your stock plan approval because you've implied, in the CD&A you've described the ownership guidelines, and then you seek shareholder approval of a share increase, and then, one of your officers or several of your officers sell in excess and take themselves below the ownership limit. That, to me, that doesn't seem like a stock plan issue as much as a, management issue.
Corporate governance.
Right, but it's coming up, and so it has disclosure implications here. Similarly, the 162M plans require, for certain purposes, that you get approval every 5 years. If you put up a 162M plan 1 year and, gotten approval of it and said we have to seek it again in 5 years, and then 5 years comes around and under the business judgment rule you've decided you don't need to do 162M compliant awards right now, so you're not going to seek approval. Have you set yourself up for where you need to get approval, even though you don't really need the approval because you're not going to follow the tax structure for reasons that would have been protected? This was interesting to us as corporate lawyers just because it really draws out the need to sit back and look at the whole context and think about the big picture beyond just the particular compensation arrangement being put up for vote.
We're going to skip the next two slides. I think they're self-explanatory. Jump into 10b5-1 plans. And here, there's a certain amount of speculation on our part as to whether this will become a big deal or not. It's primarily triggered by a series of articles by the Wall Street Journal, which has triggered some U.S. attorney investigations and SEC, and at least one SEC investigation. So it may become a major issue going forward. So I'll turn it over.
I guess I'll this is Brooke Stout, Dunder Stepner. I'll briefly summarize the and talk about how plans are implemented and then turn it over to Mike to provide an update on these Wall Street Journal articles. 10b5-1 was adopted in 2000. It's a safe harbor, or it provides an affirmative defense against insider trading claims. And it's a very short rule, and it only really has four requirements. The first requirement is that you have to adopt a plan before you have knowledge or become aware of material non-public information. The second is that the plan has to specify the number of securities that are going to be sold, the date of sale, and the price, or it has to have a formula, or it has to give discretion to someone else. The third requirement is that the trades need to occur pursuant to the plan. And the final requirement is sort of a catch-all, which is that the plan has to be implemented in good faith and not as part of a scheme or a plan to avoid insider trading. So at the time, I think the SEC adopted a very brief rule recognizing that it would be virtually impossible to sort of specify all the regulations that might apply to prevent abuses and just put a general catch-all in at the end, this good faith requirement. 10b5-1 plans are typically, you know, it's essentially just a selling plan where an insider sells stock, and the real idea of the rule is you have to not have discretion over the sales. That's why you designate somebody else to sell it, and you do it. Typically what happens is a company will have approved a list of brokers that can be used. The broker will typically have a form of plan that they use. The insider will specify the trading formula. The insider will make sure that the plan complies with the company's insider trading policy. Then there's typically a lag between when the plan is adopted and when it's effective, just to have a precaution that there's no insider information when the plan's actually adopted. And then the plan begins to operate. And these plans have been extensively used by executives. And I think all of us advising executives would characterize them as a very, very effective way to mitigate insider trading risk. But as Mike will summarize, they've been called into question in a number of recent articles.
Yeah, so the journal articles are interesting in a number of ways. First of all, it's five articles over the course of maybe a month, which I really haven't seen the journal do. They were really sort of beating the drum on this issue. In citing their theory, which is these plans have been used by insiders to essentially game the market and either avoid losses or make outside gains on company shared trading. Review of trades by over 20,000 executives during some period of time. And I'm not even sure the statistics that they cite really support the theory that they, you know, that they've been sort of trying to hammer home. What they basically found was that about 1,500 of those 20,000 executives averaged stock gains of 10% or more, or avoided losses of 10% or greater when affecting trades a week before an earnings announcement. The articles don't state whether those trades were even affected pursuant to 10b5-1 plans, and frankly, I look at those statistics and I don't really draw a conclusion that, you know, that there's this pervasive, widespread practice of insider trading by senior executives of public companies. Nevertheless, the Wall Street Journal was going to make this argument and make it repeatedly, and of course it caught the attention of the SEC and, in at least a couple of circumstances, the Southern District of New York, U.S. Attorney's Office. So the trend, according to the Wall Street Journal, is these plans are being used, abused, and insiders are outperforming the market when affecting trades pursuant to 10b5-1 plans. They've been subject to abuse by insiders through amendment or termination to the extent those actions benefit an insider. And again, no visibility into particular circumstances where insiders are, in fact, amending or terminating plans to their benefit. And that insiders can time the disclosure of their trades to benefit their algorithm or their trading plan mechanic.
And disclosure of news.
Right. So they cited a number of cases. I thought it very interesting, and I'm trying not to take too many shots at the Wall Street Journal here because I love the paper. It's very informative. One of the cases that they cited repeatedly.
I don't like something about you next.
I know. I hope we don't have a Wall Street Journal reporter on the line here. One of the biggest cases, the case that I think got the Southern District really interested was the Big Lots case, which involved the CEO exercising options and selling over $10 million in Big Lots right before a horrible earnings announcement, the week before. Now, the critical fact, I think, that was really not amplified in the articles was the fact that the trades occurred outside of the plan. So he had a 10b5-1 plan that presumably set forth some parameters that he was going to buy or sell shares in the future. He made this trade, he exercised these options and sold these shares outside of the plan within a month of a really bad earnings announcement. To me, that's just a straight insider trading case. It's really not a 10b5-1 abuse case. Now, the company's response was the sales occurred during the window that, in fact, he was clear to transact in the company's securities at that time. And as I'm sure all of us understand, that's really a facts and circumstances analysis as to when windows should be open and closed, and whether you're going to have specific restrictions on CEOs and others who may be aware of material non-public information outside of the ordinary course. So the CEO resigned of Big Lots, and apparently he's responding to inquiries from both criminal and civil authorities. So I know we've got to move along here, but it has traditionally been a sleepy area since it was rolled out in 2000. I think it was the late summer of 2000. I think there's only been one case brought, and it was part of a much larger fraud involving Countrywide, which I think we're all familiar with. So I think given the amount of media attention this has garnered, we are going to see probably some cases being brought and subpoenas being issued, perhaps with government officials trying to conduct some sort of analysis along the lines of what the Wall Street Journal affected. And then, not surprisingly, you have the plaintiff's bar jumping in and bringing claims. Interestingly, under a 1949 Delaware law decision, Brophy, which basically provides that an insider who has a duty of trust and confidence to the company breaches his or her duty of loyalty and other fiduciary duties to the company when he or she affects trades in company stock at a time when they're aware of material non-public information. So it's a derivative-based insider trading claim that was recently affirmed by a Delaware court in 2011 in the Kahn matter.
Let me ask you a question about that case. Another traditional
case, not on the basis of insider information. In other words, if you're an insider, you're not liable under the federal securities laws if you don't sell stock where you have inside information. So if you know that the stock price is going to go up because of material inside information and you decide not to sell, that's not a violation of the insider trading laws. Would you potentially be at risk in a Brophy-type situation if you didn't sell because you knew there was information coming?
I think if you had a plan which
had you scheduled to sell, and you became aware of material inside information which suggested, hey, there's good news ahead, and therefore I'm not going to sell my stock, so I'm going to cancel my plan. That might present a Brophy claim, because it's a breach of fiduciary duty by misusing corporate information, but it, no one's ever litigated it, no one's ever brought such a claim. But there certainly is a lot of talk that one of the perceived abuses of 10b5-1 plans is setting them up, and then when you start getting wind of setting them up when you don't have material information, inside information, then when you get some, and it's, you cancel the plan, and then create a new plan later down the road. And so there's going to be some focus on that issue, whether you can just cancel a plan or cancel the plan when you're in possession of material.
And I think what the lawyers will tell you now is if you cancel infrequently and wait between canceling one plan and adopting a new plan, that's probably okay. That's probably within the spirit of the rule. But I think there's the risk or the possibility that that conventional advice could be revisited.
And I just want to jump in right now to clarify. We have actually not seen any of these cases litigated yet. So there was the Wall Street Journal article and then the Shareholders Foundation and some of the other plaintiff case starters issued investigation notices into these companies. We're speculating that they might use Brophy in this way, especially now that it's been reaffirmed by the Supreme Court. But I think we're waiting to see how it plays out in terms of how the complaints are drafted and how the Delaware Court of Chancery or whichever court have the opportunity to adjudicate these issues, how it actually plays out. So we're giving you, I think, our best judgment. But because the Wall Street Journal articles are so recent, the plaintiff's bar hasn't been able to jump on it yet.
Is there an SEC filing that's made when the 10b5-1 plan is canceled?
The question that was just asked is there an SEC filing made when the 10b5-1 plan or trade, scheduled trade, is canceled?
It's a good question. Not only is there no required filing when it's terminated, there's no required filing when it's implemented, although it's considered best practice to disclose the existence of these plans.
So when you and the question always comes to me, well, we are obviously, when that executive we have members on the board and such as both training windows and et cetera, and the primary reason for us to adopt the plan is to be able to affect order or the retail of the stock, and that some of our companies do that to the business. So the question comes to me that, okay, so we adopt the plan, but we don't have material inside information, and you know we're not supposed to amend the terms or change it and all that, but can we determine when you think that something that is going to happen and you don't want to get the sales or something at that point? And my answer for now is that you can't go back and forth stopping, or it will be seen as a scheme to avoid the bad trade. What I think I'm saying, you have to be extra careful now on terminating the plan when scheduled sale is. Although when we file our plan, we request that we come to
And Brooks or Bruce or whomever is going to take that. Unfortunately, the audience, I think, isn't wired, so if you could summarize, I think the...
But really, the issue comes down to what can you safely terminate a plan?
Right.
And under what circumstances you can do that? Brooks, you want to comment?
No, I think that's right, and I think the conventional wisdom is you can do it infrequently, and it's helpful to have an independent business reason for doing it. You know, if you don't decide it not to sell, or you're going to do something else with the equity, then it's beneficial to have an independent business reason for modifying a plan. But I still think even in the absence of a compelling independent reason, there's enough flexibility in these plans to periodically terminate them. And again, we haven't seen any case assert, you know, this Brophy-type analysis in this context.
I agree with that.
And I think when the rule came out, as was referred to before, about when the rule came out, it was very sparse. Like, the rule itself doesn't say that much. It sets some general parameters sort of on an anti-fraud basis. And what happened in the 2 or 3 years after that was, like, the securities bar through the ABA and other organizations worked with the brokers and tried to come up with some guidelines that seemed sensible from a governance perspective. And, I mean, I think one of the things that happened during that time frame was, I think there's a CNDI that CorpFin has put out stating that there shouldn't be liability for refraining from trades based on a Supreme Court case that's some decades old. But I think maybe separate, may have involved a separate claim from the Delaware claim that you're talking about. And so the way the securities bar thought about this in the early years of 10b5-1 was you get one bite at the apple. So, you know, you can set up a plan, and if you need to terminate it midstream for one reason or another, probably okay to do that. But you need to be really careful then when you set up the next plan, because you're setting yourself up to you know, possibly face some concern about, you know, not doing these things in good faith and not doing them with the intention of following through on them. And so I think most of the corporate governance guidelines or the 10b5-1 guidelines that companies adopt under their insider trading policies, many of them address that, you know, if you do terminate a plan on a discretionary basis, you have to wait some period of time to set up another plan. And I think as part of the general preclearance process that the company would impose, you know, if it looked like an insider was doing something that might cause trouble, they might impose, you know, suggest the person refrain for longer periods if it was appropriate.
And I am going to jump in very quickly to take us to the code that I understand New York needs. I should be showing on your screens right now. We are towards the end of the hour, and I think we'd like to continue the discussion, especially with those present or anyone who wants to remain on the line. But if anyone needs to jump off, I wanted to make sure you get the code, and it is KMR011513, M like Mary, K, T like Tom, G. That should be showing, and with that, we'll resume our conversation, but if anyone needs to jump off, I just wanted to make sure our New York participants do have their assigned codes and everyone gets their email. Sorry, Sharon. I can turn it back to you, or...
I think I can wrap up the 10b5-1 part. We're on the slide factors to consider. So if you go back one slide. So this was just an attempt to list. As Sharon mentioned, the rule's very brief, and there are a number of areas where actions could be alleged to not be taken in good faith, and this was our attempt to kind of put together a laundry list of potential actions, and I won't review all of them here, but some of them are fairly straightforward, like, you know, frequently amending a plan or frequently terminating a plan or timing public disclosures to benefit plan sales. I mean, there are a number of things that when you just think about it, you could see how an objective observer could question whether those actions are in good faith. And then there are probably some things that I think most of us would say clearly step beyond what's permitted, including hedging transactions, trying to influence the broker who's supposed to have the discretion to sell your stock, or sharing inside information with your broker. So I think these are sort of areas where you might want to exercise particular caution. And then finally, we just summarized what I would say are a standard list of best practices. And I don't know that we have the time to go through all of these, but what I would say is that at a high level is I think there's a relatively well-developed body of best practices. And if you follow those best practices, I think 10b5-1 plans continue to provide a lot of benefit to people that use them. I mean, they're sort of cheap insurance, really.
Yeah, to me, I think the last point on this slide is probably the most significant one, having reviewed all the commentary with the recent scrutiny, at least from the Wall Street Journal on these plans, and that is the concept of having a sufficient lag between when you adopt the plan and when you execute the first trade. I know there can be compelling personal and business reasons to shorten that gap, but if there is if there's discretion and there's an ability to delay, have a significant lag, up to 90 days, if that's possible, that can be, frankly, dispositive. It can disabuse, you know, a regulator of any notion that the insider was in possession of material non-public information at the time they entered into the plan. So something to bear in mind.
Okay, then I think we'll go to the next slide, which is, I put the mic back over to you.
Oh, what to do if sued? Always a great topic.
Hire a litigator.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Hire an experienced litigator in this area. So, you know, you may want to conduct your own internal review. If you're with a company that has a number of executives that have used these plans over time, it probably doesn't hurt to, even before, you know, a plaintiff's attorney or the SEC comes calling, take a quick look back and see if you can chart out the performance. And if something looks aberrational, you may want to do a follow-up on that. And if it's significant enough, have counsel involved in a look back and interview process and sort of internal investigative process with the insider involved in the matter.
If I can point out one real disconnect in what's coming out of this from the Wall Street Journal articles and the investigations is that, I mean, the companies over the years have really deeply accepted that it is better for the insiders to sell under 10b5-1 plans, to the point where there are companies whose policy is insiders must sell under 10b5-1 plans and not do one-off trades. And so when, you know, in terms of doing internal reviews and your own statistical analysis, I mean, it really will, at some level, cause companies to sit back and reassess the whole governance, you know, the improved governance that they've spent a decade trying to adopt.
Sure.
So moving on to the Q&A, I did want to just, and feel free, please, if you have other time commitments, but we did have some questions from our online viewers that I thought were worth a group discussion. And I would probably direct the first of these towards Bruce, although anyone chime in. Why do you feel that plaintiffs are focusing on these cases now? Why are we seeing the shift?
Shift. Is that the word you use?
Well, there was an app there, yes.
I think part of it is that if you look at the studies, the number of 10b-5 class action cases have declined in light of the Reform Act, and so they're looking for other ways to do business. And these cases are very appealing to them because they put in almost no effort. They get a quick payday, and the extortionate part of it works for them. And so as long as people are going to keep settling, not putting up any fight, and they're going to have some occasional successes, it's a business for them. And as Monteverdi described, it's a cash cow for their practice.
So I suppose the next question ties on to that. We saw during the presentation that some of these cases have been settled. Why are companies settling them, and what are the costs of fighting the case?
I think companies are settling them because the price is sufficiently low to pay the fees. The disclosures are relatively painless, and it's a sensitive area for companies. Their executive compensation, certainly don't want to discourage their executives from performing, posing any threat to their comp packages. So it's, you know, risk-reward situation. I think the prices are going to start going up, and then it'll be interesting to see what happens at that point.
Are there any insurance implications here? Is any of it being driven by either D&O or E&O policies or anything?
I'm sorry, Bruce. An audience question. Are there insurance implications? I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm told the participants on the webcast can't hear all.
Are there insurance implications from this? Most insurance policies have a retention that's below what they will take to settle these cases. So insurance companies, by and large, aren't being affected by these cases. In terms of litigating them, you know, if you litigate through the preliminary injunction stage, you know, it's probably a couple hundred thousand dollars typically because you have expedited discovery and all of that. So, what you may see is what's happening in the merger context, which is a number of the insurance carriers are creating a special retention for merger cases, a much higher retention. It's like $1 million for merger cases because they're getting killed by those merger cases.
And we do have a few additional questions, but I think in the interest of time, we'll wrap up and follow up with anyone online. Unless anyone else in the room has further questions you'd like to ask or go into, we are going to make these materials available to you. I've had a number of people ask if they are going to be available, and we will make sure that our attendees are able to get a copy of the material going forward. And unless there are any other questions from the people who are live. With that, I think we will conclude. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you.